this is.
Yeah.
We should get started. I guess I'm supposed to say for the tape that I'm Ron Sider. Is the tape working? Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Now it is.
Now it is. And today I want to talk about the second major tradition in the Christian Church with regard to war and violence, namely the nonviolent or pacifist tradition. I can't resist the following line, although I probably shouldn't say it. Please don't turn off as a result. I started the fire primarily because I thought it would be nice and feel good, but it also occurred to me as I was carrying the bundle of wood that it could be perhaps symbolic. 400 years ago, my ancestors were burned at the stake for what I'm going to say this afternoon by by Lutherans, by Calvinists, by Catholics. So we've got a fire. If anyone feels the need to carry on the tradition, why, we'll see who can make the door first. Looks like the fire is going to make it. Let me then begin by giving you an overview of the argument and then coming back and developing it in its different stages. Peace among men on earth, the angels sang when God's Son came into our midst as a helpless infant. Does this echo in a bad way for the rest of you? Okay, it doesn't. I hear it echoing around there. Because I'm up underneath here, but if it doesn't bother you, why, it's okay. The Jews of Jesus' day had long awaited the messianic age of peace foreseen by the prophets, but they expected that the peaceful age would come only after the Messiah had violently driven out the oppressive Romans. The babe of Bethlehem claimed, I believe, to be the Messiah. He announced that the long-expected messianic age had actually broken into the present, and the time of peace and righteousness was actually arriving. But he disappointed the passionate nationalists with his summons to love enemies, even hated Roman oppressors. He grounded this radical summons in the very nature of God, who, he said, also loves his enemies. As Messiah and Son of God, he claimed divine authority to forgive sins, and he pointed to his death and his resurrection as the keys to understanding these otherwise blasphemous claims. After the resurrection, his followers continued to teach and live his nonviolent way. They also offered to a divided, broken world a new community, a community where hostile walls between Jews and Gentiles, between men and women, between slaves and masters were crumbling. Like Jesus, they grounded their radical message and their revolutionary social order. It was a new society. It was radical. They grounded all of that in the atonement, in the cross, in their understanding of the cross. They loved their enemies, they said, because God himself had reconciled his sinful enemies when God the Son died on the cross for our sins. Jesus' self-sacrificial death for others was for them two things. It was, first of all, the unrepeatable ground of their acceptance with God, and second, it was the central clue for their ethics. Amen. Before Easter, this way of love seemed impossible, even to the disciples like Peter, but the resurrection of Pentecost changed everything. It removed their doubt about who he was, and it gave them a new energy to live that way. Well, that, in brief, is the argument that I want to develop at more length. First of all, let me take a look at the coming of the Messianic Kingdom. The Gospels summarize Jesus' message with the simple words, "The time is fulfilled, the kingdom of God is at hand." What did he mean? Well, some people think that he didn't mean that the kingdom was actually present, it was nearby in the future. Others think that it was entirely present. I think that, although there's not a scholarly consensus, that the the most convincing scholarly position is that for Jesus, the kingdom, which he announced, was already present in his life and his work, but it was also coming in its fullness and completion at a time in the future. Well, announcing that the Messianic kingdom was arriving was fantastic. It made the Jews extremely excited. But the demands of the kingdom, which Jesus announced, cooled everybody's ardor. Because Jesus said that his kingdom, the kingdom values of his new messianic society, were radical. He said that they challenged, he didn't say, they just in fact did, challenge the status quo. At every point it was wrong. If we had time, we could look at that. We could see the way Jesus just cut through the lack of respect for women. Jesus treated women as equals. He discussed theology with them. Jesus rejected the easy divorce laws of the time, which men were happy with because they could get rid of their wives on almost any pretext. Jesus challenged the revolutionaries of his time, the violent guerrillas, the zealots. He said, love your enemies in all kinds of ways, not least, of course, his challenge of the economic establishment when he said, make loans even if you're not going to get repaid. In all kinds of ways, Jesus challenged the status quo. He said that his new kingdom called people to live in radically new kinds of ways. Now, there's another thing about Jesus' messianic kingdom that's important, and that is that it differed sharply in its strategy from other views of how to bring in the kingdom that were around in Jesus' day. All of the Jews, almost all of the Jews at Jesus' time, longed for the coming of the kingdom, but they had different ways of bringing it in. The Essenes, those people who went out into the desert, you know, and we've discovered the Dead Sea Scrolls, they thought that if they could just persuade everybody to engage in ritual purity, and they had various rules for that, then the Messiah would come. The Pharisees thought that if they could just persuade everybody to keep the law and all the details of the law that they had worked out to guard the Mosaic law, if everybody would just do that, then the Messiah would come. Most interestingly, the Zealots, the revolutionaries, thought that if they could just persuade everybody to engage in armed rebellion against Rome, then the Messiah would come. Different messianic strategies. Jesus did not opt for any of those. Jesus chose a different one. But I want to look at the Zealots just a little bit more. It's hardly surprising, I think. There was a lot of oppression around. The Jews, you remember the Maccabees, they had fought and won their independence. It lasted for 100 years or so. And then the Romans took over about 60 BC. And Rome was Judea, Palestine, was a colony of Rome. The Jews didn't like that at all. They were looking eagerly for the time when the Messiah would come and free them from all of that. So there was intense messianic speculation. They were all looking for that new age. Now, it's not surprising that the Romans weren't very excited about all this messianic speculation. In fact, the Romans considered it treason. The Romans regularly crucified or otherwise killed messianic pretenders who came along in the first century. They crucified them as dangerous radicals who were challenging Roman rule. When Herod the Great died, just at Jesus' birth, just after Jesus' birth, three different messianic pretenders provoked armed rebellion. The Roman governor of Syria had to come up to Jerusalem. He probably crucified 2,000 rebels at that time, near Jesus' birth. Judas, who was probably a founder of the Zealots, a few years later, attacked an arsenal of Herod the king, 3 miles from Jesus' home. I say that to underline the fact that there was a lot of violence going on in Jesus' day, and there was a lot of intense messianic speculation and violent claims. So the Zealots, of course, were the most striking example of that. They were deeply religious. They were committed to the law, but they thought that the way to bring in the messianic time was to commit violence and to persuade everybody to do that. They finally succeeded in 66 AD, and the Jewish war broke out, and eventually Rome destroyed Jerusalem. Well, in Jesus' day then, the question of violent revolution was a burning issue, perhaps the political issue of the day. And the zealot answer of violence was popular. It was into that kind of oppressive, and the Romans were oppressive against the Jews in lots of ways, into that kind of oppressive, violent context, Jesus comes along and says, love your enemies. And he grounds that, as we shall see, in the very nature of God. Let's look next at Jesus' nonviolent life briefly, and then at greater length, his nonviolent teaching. In his actions, Jesus rejected lethal violence. At the triumphal entry, Jesus clearly disclosed the nonviolent messianic conception that he had. Both Matthew and John quote the text from Zechariah, it's chapter 9, verse 9, to underline their belief that Jesus fulfilled this Old Testament prophecy from Zechariah. Modern commentators agree that Jesus consciously chose to fulfill the prophecy of Zechariah about a messianic time, precisely because it depicted a humble, peaceful Messiah. Zechariah's peaceful vision contrasts sharply with most messianic expectation. Here's the way Zechariah 9:9-10 goes. Lo, your king comes to you, triumphant and victorious is he. Now and then you expect a war horse, don't you? And it is humble and riding on an ass, on a colt, the foal of an ass. I will cut off the chariot from Ephraim, and the war horse from Jerusalem, and the battle bow shall be cut off, and he shall command peace to the nations. That's the messianic picture that Jesus saw himself fulfilling. And that's why he told his disciples to go and get the ass so that he could ride into Jerusalem, making a messianic claim, to be sure, but insisting that it was a peaceful kind of claim. The crowds were excited. They said, blessed is the king, hosanna to the son of David. These were messianic slogans. But Jesus had a different picture. And when Jesus did not move to take over after he rode into Jerusalem, the crowds were intensely disappointed and they quickly deserted him. So at the triumphal entry, Jesus points in a striking way to his nonviolent understanding of his messiahship. And in the final crisis, Jesus persisted in the rejection of the sword. He rebuked Peter for attacking those who came to arrest him. All who take the sword will perish by the sword, he said. Not even the defensive sword, not even a sword of defense is to be used. I think it's significant that Jesus rebukes Peter here and gives a general reason for not using the sword. It's not just an objection to using the sword in this particular case. Well, what about Jesus' actual teaching in Matthew 5? The important passage, of course, Matthew 5, 38-48 is the central passage. And I think it's important enough to read it again. Just listen to it. You've heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist one who is evil. But if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if anyone would sue you and take your coat, let him have your cloak as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. Give to him who begs from you, and do not refuse him who would borrow from you. You have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven. For he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the just and on the unjust. For if you love those who love you, what reward have you? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? And if you salute only your brethren, what more are you doing than others? Do not even the Gentiles do the same? You, therefore, must be perfect, as your heavenly Father is perfect. Remember, Jesus says this to a people who had been oppressed by foreign conquerors for over a century, a people who had resorted to armed rebellion more than once in the last several hundred years. To those people, he says, love your enemies. The German New Testament scholar, Lutheran New Testament scholar, Martin Hengel at Tübingen, thinks that Jesus formulated this command to love one's enemies in conscious contrast to the teaching and the practice of the zealots, the revolutionaries that I talked about. If that's true, then Jesus was consciously rejecting one popular political method in favor of a different political strategy. Now notice that Jesus' command to love one's enemies differs or contrasts sharply with widespread views that Jesus points to in verse 43. You've heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. Now, the first part of that verse, love your neighbor, is, of course, just a quotation from Leviticus 19:18. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. But who is the neighbor? That's part of the question for us. The first part of Leviticus 19:18 indicates that the neighbor is a son of our own people. This was the normal Jewish viewpoint. Neighbor love, according to the Jews, was basically restricted to people who are part of the ethnic community of Israel. Now, that's not to say that the Old Testament did not teach that you should hate other folk, but people in Jesus' own context did. The Zealots said, slaying of the godless enemy out of zeal for God's cause was a fundamental commandment, true to the rabbinic maxim, whoever spills the blood of one of the godless is like one who offers a sacrifice. So the Zealots were saying that it's a good thing to kill the wicked. And the Qumran community, those quiet people in the Dead Sea Scrolls, from the Dead Sea Scrolls, said, love all the sons of light and hate all the sons of darkness. So it's that kind of thing that Jesus is referring to, probably, when he says, you've heard it said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. Now, Jesus teaches a very different way. Loving those who love you, Jesus says, is pretty easy. Even great sinners can manage that. In fact, the pagan Gentiles even do it. They manage to love people in their own ethnic community. Jesus totally rejects this kind of limited love only for people in one's religious or ethnic circle. For the members of Jesus' new messianic kingdom, neighbor love must extend way out beyond the limited circle of one's religious group. This text says explicitly what the parable of the Good Samaritan says by way of suggestion. All people everywhere are neighbors to Jesus' followers, and therefore everybody is to be actively loved. And that even includes enemies, even violent, aggressive, foreign conquerors. Now, the difficulty of really implementing that text has led to a number of attempts to weaken it. I think that one of the most significant that I need to talk about is that of Martin Luther. You, I'm sure, know about the way that Martin Luther developed a two-kingdom analysis. Luther restricts the application of these verses on love for enemies to the personal sphere. He denies that they have any application in public life, so that they apply in the kingdom of Christ, in the church, in personal life, but they do not apply at all in the kingdom of this world, in public life, in government. Now, exegetically, it seems to me this is a highly questionable argument. Edward Schweitzer, another New Testament scholar, has said in his commentary on Matthew, there's not the slightest hint of any realm where the disciple is not bound by the words of Jesus. The context demonstrates that Jesus intended the command to apply to the public sphere. I want to develop that. I think it's important. In verses 39 to 41, Jesus discusses issues that clearly talk about the public sphere, about the law courts, about the Roman rulers. When Jesus rejects the principle, for instance, of an eye for an eye, he's not merely talking about some kind of personal, private rule for personal interrelationships. He's talking about a basic legal principle of the Mosaic Law, a basic legal principle of all Near Eastern jurisprudence. Instead of demanding what the law permitted, namely an eye for an eye, full retaliation, instead of permitting that, Jesus commands a loving response governed by the needs of the other person. One should even submit, Jesus says, to further damage instead of retaliating. In verse 40, if anyone would sue you and take your coat, let him have your cloak as well. That obviously is talking about how you respond in the public arena of the judicial system. And verse 41, if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. That's talking about how you relate to the Roman conquerors. The word force here is a technical word. It talks about the right that the Roman conquerors had of going to anyone and saying, you're supposed to carry military supplies for a certain distance. That's what that verb means. Jesus says, when the Roman conquerors ask you to carry their supplies, you're supposed to do it. So, Jesus is talking here about a number of things that relate to the public sphere. The law courts, how you relate to the Roman government, and so on. He's taking a different approach than the zealots. They wanted to reject any kind of demand on the part of the Romans to carry supplies. Jesus said, no, that kind of angry response is not my way. Now, all of this immediately raises a tough question. Is Jesus forbidding all forms of resistance to evil? Is he suggesting a total non-resistance? Are we not supposed to take any action against evil? I want to say, no, I don't think so. I want to distinguish between lethal violence and non-lethal violence. If Jesus was meaning to reject all kinds of coercion, then he contradicted his own teaching. At a number of points, Jesus was very vigorous in confronting evil. At a number of points, Jesus vigorously resisted evil persons. A couple examples. Remember the blistering attack on the Pharisees. Jesus denounced them as blind guides, fools, hypocrites, and a brood of vipers. He uttered a harsh public condemnation of their many errors. Remember what he did when he walked into the temple? He dumped over the money changers' tables. He took out a whip and he drove the animals out. Now that's an act of civil disobedience. Nonviolent, to be sure. I doubt that anybody got killed with his whip. I doubt that he even used it on persons. No indication that he did. But certainly vigorous confrontation of evil. Even at his trial, when a soldier unjustly struck him on the cheek, what did he do? He didn't just turn the other cheek. He said in John 18, 19-24, if I have spoken wrongly, bear witness to the wrong. But if I have spoken rightly, why do you strike me? Apparently, Jesus thought that protesting police brutality was perfectly consistent with what he had said about not resisting evil. We need, then, some kind of distinction between lethal violence and nonviolent coercion, even though the text of Matthew 5 doesn't explicitly talk about it. Otherwise, we have Jesus contradicting his own teaching, and I don't think that that's, in fact, what happened. Well, what then does Matthew 5, 29 mean? Resist not one who is evil. I think it means four very radical things. I think it means that one should not respond to an evil person by placing him or her in the category of enemies. We should not put people in the category of enemies. Second, I think that we should not retaliate, but rather respond always with a concern for the needs of the other person. Third, regardless of the offending person's response, we must continue to love, because our love does not depend on reciprocity. And finally, we need to do that sort of thing, even at great personal cost. The accepted norm in Jesus' day was an eye for an eye. Its fundamental principle was retaliation. Limited, of course, to the nature of the offense. You could only take one eye if one eye of yours had been taken out. Jesus' followers are to reject retaliation. They're to love their enemies. They're not to commit violence. I think that's the teaching that Jesus gives us in Matthew 5. Now, I want to look a little further at the objection that I pointed to a little bit ago. In a number of different ways, different versions of ethical dualism have been offered to enable us to get around the kind of understanding of Jesus that I've just suggested. In the Middle Ages, the way it was done was to say that ordinary Christians just obey the commands. The monks and people of that sort obey the counsels of perfection. And of course, loving your enemies is a counsel of perfection. It's not obligatory for everybody, just for the monks, for the religious. Luther's view we've already talked about. Jesus' command to love our enemies applies within the church. It applies in private life, but not in public life. Another way to do it is with dispensationalists. who say that Jesus' teaching on loving your enemy will be applicable only when the kingdom comes in the morning. And finally, Reinhold Niebuhr. He believes that Jesus really rejected all violence. But Niebuhr says that that's an impossible sort of thing to do in a sinful world, and so we have to just ignore Jesus at that point, largely. Now, the most common version of this kind of dualism is the distinction between the personal and public roles of the Christian. In one's personal role, it's argued the Christian must always refuse to retaliate. But the same person acting in the public role of judge or soldier rightly retaliates, rightly kills. Jesus then was not forbidding capital punishment or war on the part of duly authorized Christian executioners and duly authorized Christian soldiers. He was merely forbidding private retaliation on the part of individuals who want to take the law into their own hands. Now let me respond to that. I think that that's finally not right for several reasons. For one thing, I think it ignores the historical context of Jesus' teaching. Second, I think it overlooks the most natural meaning of the text. Third, it relies on a pragmatism. And finally, it neglects the first three centuries of Christian teaching. Just briefly, those four points. First of all, in Jesus' historical context, Jesus came as the Messiah of Israel. He came with a plan and an ethic for the entire Jewish people. He advocated love toward enemies, even political enemies, as his specific political response to centuries of violence. His radical nonviolence was a conscious alternative to the contemporary zealots' call for violent revolution to usher in the Messianic kingdom. There's no hint in Jesus that Jesus' reason for objecting to the zealots was that they were unauthorized individuals. No hint that their violent sword would have been fine if the Sanhedrin would have just given the order. On the contrary, his point was that the zealots' whole approach to enemies, even unjust oppressive foreigners, was fundamentally wrong. The zealots offered one political approach, Jesus offered another, but both appealed to the entire Jewish nation, not just to individuals and not just to individual persons. So my first point then is that to say that Jesus' teaching in Matthew 5 applies only in one's personal life ignores this historical context where Jesus is offering a different political strategy for the whole Jewish nation. My second reason for rejecting it is that it seems to go against the most natural, literal meaning of the text. There's no hint in the text of this kind of distinction. Jesus himself says that it applies in the courts. It applies when you deal with government. The most natural conclusion is that Jesus intended his words to be normative, not just in private life, but also in public life. It seems to me the burden of proof is on those who think otherwise. Third, there's an essential pragmatism in the argument that I'm refuting. You know, the argument goes like this. In a sinful, fallen world where people are wicked and violent, it just won't work to love your enemies. Now, it may be the case that love will not work. That's a factual claim that may or may not be right. We could argue about that. But what is surely most important for Christians, however, is the essential pragmatism of the argument. Surely the pragmatic question of whether Jesus' ethic works, that is, whether or not it enables me to avoid suffering, surely that pragmatic question dare not be decisive in any understanding of what Jesus really meant. And finally, my fourth and last point here, is that the first three centuries of the Christian church offer weighty evidence against this personal-public distinction, where the love your enemies applies in personal life but not in public life. We have a lot of material from Christian writers in the first three centuries. Not a single writer, there's no extant document from Christian writers in the first three centuries that says anything except participating in war is contrary to Jesus. They reject both capital punishment and participating in war. And they say that this is because of what Jesus taught. That's the unanimous teaching of all of the Christian writings that we have. for the first 3 centuries, up until the time of Constantine. Now, there's one final piece of my whole argument. I've talked about the teaching of Jesus, and I've grounded the case that I'm trying to make for a nonviolent approach in the teaching of Jesus. But I think that there's an even deeper foundation. I think that finally, the foundation of Christian nonviolence is the cross. It doesn't rest in some calculation of effectiveness. The ultimate ground is in the cross of Jesus Christ. There's one aspect of Matthew 5 that I haven't talked about yet, and that is Jesus' reason for saying that we should love our enemies. Why does he say that? Jesus says that that's the way God treats his enemies. Love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. Why? So that you may be sons of your Father who is in heaven, for he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the just and on the unjust. God continues with love, even for unjust, wicked people, even for enemies. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called sons of God. God loves his enemies. Instead of promptly destroying sinners, God showers the good gifts of creation upon them. And he says that his sons and daughters are supposed to do the same. Now, the ultimate statement of all of this, of course, comes in St. Paul. Paul says in Romans 5, 8 and 10, God shows his love for us in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. While we were enemies, we were reconciled to God by the death of his Son. Jesus' vicarious cross for sinners is the foundation and the deepest expression, I think, of Jesus' command to love one's enemies. As the substitutionary view of the atonement makes clear, we're enemies of God in a double sense. You and I are enemies of God in a double sense. One, we have rebelled against God, and so we're in active hostility to him. And two, Paul says that God hates sin. He can't tolerate sin. And so in that sense, too, we're enemies of God. For those who know the law, failure to obey it, Paul says, results in a divine curse. But then Christ redeems us from that curse by becoming a curse for us. Jesus' blood on the cross then was an expiation for sinful enemies of God. Jesus was dying for his enemies. That's the point that I want to make. I think nothing discloses the horror of sin as deeply as the cross. The cross is no cheap, easy, indulgent amnesty. Sin's an outrage against God. You know, it would be a horrible, intolerable world if sin, evil, and injustice would continue to rampage and destroy forever unchecked and unpunished. The cross demonstrates that the holy sovereign of the universe will not tolerate that kind of thing. Sin's penalty must be paid. But the cross is not the sacrifice of a human victim on the altar of an angry deity. That would deny the doctrine of the Trinity and the doctrine of the Incarnation. God himself suffers. God himself bears the penalty of sin. God himself bears the awful consequences of our rebellion. Jesus' death on the cross, then, for sinful enemies of God, is the foundation for my commitment to nonviolence. It was because the Incarnate One knew that God was loving and merciful, even toward the worst of sinners, that he associated with sinners, forgave their sins, and then completed his mission by dying for the sins of the world. And it was precisely the same understanding of God that prompted him to command his followers to love their enemies. Now, we'll never fathom all of the mystery of the cross, but it's precisely because the one hanging limp on the middle cross was God become flesh. It's precisely for that reason that we know two things. First, that God accepts us just as we are. We're justified by faith alone. And second, that since God has treated his enemies in that way, he wants us to go and treat our enemies in exactly the same way. Well, how does all this apply to the nuclear question. Obviously, if what I've said is right, then followers of Jesus cannot be involved in making plans to destroy even 1 million, much less tens of millions of people. But there's another important way in which it applies. The New Testament repeatedly calls on Christians to follow the way of the cross in overcoming evil. I rather think that God is calling Christians to do that today, to suffer for others, so that others may escape the horror of nuclear war. I suspect that if large numbers of Christians really began to confront the governments of the world in effective ways on the nuclear question, that some of us would suffer. Probably some would go to jail. We might suffer in lots of other ways, even more serious ways. But it seems to me that that's exactly what the cross is about, among other things. As ethical clue, the cross calls us to take suffering on ourselves for the sake even of people who seem to be our enemies. Okay, that leaves us 20 minutes plus for discussion. Again, don't hesitate to disagree with me.
I often wonder about the condition of World War II, where a group like the Nazis decided that they wanted power and that they would use violent means to get that power, and even just kill the Jews for no particular reason. As a country, or as countries in the world, I'm not so sure that I can say that it's a good idea to passively sit by and let them do that. And yet on the other hand, I see your statement is what Jesus is saying. I don't know. I think that there are many sides to the issue, and yet what you're saying is an unconditional statement. What Jesus said, in fact, you know, about violence, to turn the other cheek. He did not limit that in any way. And yet, on the other hand, I don't think that God wants us to allow people in our society to run rampant, like such as murderers, because often the police force has to be violent to stop a murderer. And do we simply allow a lunatic to kill others?
Yes, I think that what you just said, you know, is a very good reflection of the struggle we all feel. Just to clarify what I'm saying, I do not think that the teaching of Jesus means that we should not actively resist evil, whether social injustice via politics or criminals via police activity national aggression via national self-defense. I'm committed to doing all of those things, but doing them nonviolently. And I think that there, in fact, are ways to do that. Tomorrow, I'm going to talk about civilian-based defense, and I'm going to share about some examples of historically of how societies have defended themselves, and suggest that a realistic, practical alternative to nuclear weapons would be training our whole society in civilian-based national defense, but I won't say more about that right now. I just want to say one more thing with regard to the police. I don't think that the way that we've trained our police is the only way to go. You know, I think it's a kind of frontier approach where you give them pistols and that's the only thing that's occurred to anybody. But I think that the British bobbies, for instance, mostly have been unarmed,
for a long, long time. I think we need some way of handling armed criminals, but I think if we were to spend half as much money as we spend on violent kinds of approaches, developing things like tranquilizers, we can shoot tranquilizers from quite a long distance. There are various ways the Israelis went in with you know, massive foam when they wanted to get rid of nonviolently of the protesters who were in the town of the Gaza Strip. You know, I think there'd be lots of ways to handle armed criminals. So I'm not in favor. I'm not in favor of getting rid of police. I want us to have police. I want us to resist evil, but I want to do it nonviolently. Yeah.
Be that as it may, is it your position, to be specific about this, that a Christian really, under the given context of today's laws and today's usage of pistols or armed weapons of some kind, can a Christian legitimately be a policeman or a Brinks armed guard or a soldier for his country or her country with what you've taught us or the case you presented today?
I could conceivably do the first two, as long as I made it clear to myself and other folk that I wasn't going to shoot people. But I probably wouldn't do that. I think, that given what's expected of policemen and the folk who ride the trucks, and drinks and all that, probably I wouldn't do that.
You might be willing to get the job, but you wouldn't get it. Your employers would not employ you on that basis.
You're quite right.
Right.
And no, I couldn't go into the army.
Then what would our society be like without those who, quote, would be unchristian, end quote, but be willing to do for you as a Christian what you are unwilling to do?
Well, I want to argue that it would be much better if all of us, with Christians in the lead, would develop a non-lethal alternative for defending our society. See, I want to defend democracy and freedom. I think that the evidence is more and more convincing that we've got ourselves into an impossible impasse. You know, the way we've tried to defend ourselves through violence and through ever more sophisticated technology for committing violence has led us to a nuclear situation where it looks like, you know, somebody like Admiral Rickover, one of our most responsible leaders, says we're going to kill ourselves and destroy the world. You know, that's an impossible situation. So it seems to me we need an alternative. And I think that we need to take a really good look at civilian-based defense. But I want to develop that at some length tomorrow.
Didn't the soldier come to Jesus and ask him what was to be? And I don't remember specifically what he answered, but it was just not to end more violence than was necessary to keep the peace.
A soldier came to John the Baptist, and John the Baptist said, don't complain about your wages, and what was the other part of what he said?
I'm not sure the answer, but I remember a soldier did ask the question, what must we do?
Yeah, I don't think that John the Baptist, you know, is normative for us. It's quite clear in the Old Testament that God commands people to kill others. And if the text is accurate, and some people suggested that they just misunderstood, that God didn't really command that, but again and again and again, the Old Testament says that God told them to kill every man, woman, and child. Now, that doesn't help the just war tradition, because it goes way beyond what the just war tradition says. It actually commands what the just war tradition calls murder. So it doesn't help the just war tradition to appeal to the Old Testament.
I would say that it's Jesus' teaching that transcends the Old Testament and John the Baptist. Now, a soldier does come to Jesus and to Paul, and some have said the text does not say that they were supposed to leave the army. That's, of course, an argument from silence. Jesus also dealt with prostitutes and the thief on the cross without saying that prostitution or thievery was wrong. So one has to be careful with that kind of argument.
What if somebody, say, personally attacks you? As a Christian, is it your responsibility to do nothing about it?
To do something about it, yeah. But not to kill him.
No.
In fact, in a kind of immediate situation of assault, rape, or someone coming at you with a gun in your home, the studies almost all indicate that the best thing is not to try to run for your pistol, but to respond non-violently, maybe depending on circumstances, to yell out. Track attention, but not.
You would not hit him though, or strike the person.
I wouldn't consider that wrong. I think that frequently that would be counterproductive. He's probably better at that than I am, and so I'd probably come out much the worse. But I wouldn't consider it contrary to Jesus to to kick him in the leg, or if I could wrestle him down, or.
Suppose in doing that, though, he hit his head and you killed him.
Yeah, that would be absolutely. If your intention wasn't to kill him.
Yeah, I want to be pretty careful at that point, but I think so. I would not use, the kind of karate blows that sometimes kill. I don't even know it anyway, but I wouldn't learn that sort of thing. The kind of coercion I would use would be the kind that. All normal circumstances doesn't kill. Yeah, here and then over here.
So have you ever had anybody directly threaten your life? Not just a theoretical thing, but in terms of, you speculate about what am I doing under given circumstances, but I'm curious to know if anybody has ever threatened your life. I mean directly to you as a person. I just say the bomb is a threat to our life, but somebody has personally you threatened your life.
I don't think so. I've lived in the inner city, and I've been in contexts where it might have happened. But
it's dangerous. So. I mean, to have somebody say to you,
so.
"Yeah, that happened to me a few years ago. The man told me he's going to kill me."
Yeah.
And that made a really strange difference in how I felt about that person.
Yeah.
I wondered what I would do.
Yeah.
He told me he was going to kill me,
yeah.
And that really made me feel very strange about that person, and I wondered how I would react in a circumstance where he made some threatening approach to my life. I wondered what I would do. And I think I know what I would do. I wouldn't even throw a Bible at him. I would yell at him with everything I had. That's the reaction I had, that if he threatened my life, he had already made it declared what his intention was, that I would defend myself.
I don't have any doubt that that would be my natural instinct.
Yeah, that was my natural instinct.
I hope
that wasn't very pious, I guess. But
you've got to be born again.
But that's a strange phenomenon, and that really bothered me. That really bothered me that I wondered, because my feelings of how I would react if this person appeared. And I happened to, my church office happened to be a place where I was on a second floor, the office was on the second floor, and for a long time after that, whenever I worked down there alone at night, when I went out in the evening, I would reach out and turn on the lights in the hallway and look around.
Yeah.
Now, that's a very strange feeling, but I did that for a long time afterwards.
Yeah.
And because I didn't trust my reactions to what would happen if that guy appeared on the scene.
Yeah.
And he wouldn't have been very threatening either, believe me.
Someone over here? Okay.
I was just going to say I think that's really true. I think that's a natural response that everyone would have. And however, I think what you're talking about is a real conscious decision to try and avoid something like that. But I also think that whole kind of mentality of self-defense is what our war structure depends upon. I haven't talked to that many people who've been part of World War II, but I know a lot of people who were in Vietnam, friends older than myself who who went over with that same kind of idea that, you know, that they never wanted to kill anybody. And suddenly when you have someone coming over the hill shooting at you, you start to defend yourself by killing people. And pretty soon you just become numb to that whole idea of that once you thought you weren't going to kill somebody because they're shooting at you and you shoot at them, and the people on the other side are using that exact same mentality. They're defending their life, so everyone is doing what they don't want to do, or maybe a large percentage of people. There are a lot of people who enjoy it, too, perhaps. But I think a lot of the people in that situation are simply there because they're killing other people simply because they feel that their own life is threatened. And I think that's just when you think about the absurdity of that and the tragedy of that, it's really incredible.
I was going to say one thing earlier about World War II. And that one's tough. That's, you know, the resistance to Hitler is often put forward with a lot of plausibility as sort of the classic case of a just war. What is especially striking to me is the failure to apply the just war criteria by the Christians on the other side. I mean, the theory of a just war assumes that one side is just and the other is not. You can't both be just in a given conflict. And we assume that we were just in resisting Hitler, which means that Hitler was unjust in what he was doing and the violence he was using. But as in virtually every other war, I mean, there's no war in history where the Christians have actually, in the course of the war, applied the just war criteria and resisted the war. Maybe the Vietnam War is an exception, but that's the only one. In the case of Hitler, you get, there's been a very careful study of German Catholics. And in the course of the war, prominent Catholic leaders actually said to their people, do not apply the just war criteria. The question of whether or not the war is just can only be answered scientifically after the war is over. Yeah. Go ahead and with a good conscience fight for your nation. So, one of the, I think, things that really needs to be wrestled with is if one takes a just war tradition approach, one needs to struggle with the fact that Christians have never been able to apply it. In other words, it doesn't work.
I didn't hear your presentation yesterday on the just war theory, so maybe you spoke to this, but it seems to me being applied across the board presently in the whole of the Iran debate, with the exception of the radical pacifists. Everyone else is using it. The simple statement that the destruction wrought from the nuclear exchange would so far outweigh any benefits gained, that particular assumption depends upon, if not the just war doctrine, certainly something that is logically analogous.
Yes, in fact, what I did yesterday was simply to take the just war criteria, accept it, and apply it to the nuclear question. And a number of Christians are doing that. So perhaps I should make another exception. It hasn't yet changed any public policy, but it is the case that a significant number of Christians are applying the just war criteria today on the nuclear question, and they're concluding that nuclear war would never be justified. And I think that's exceedingly important. In fact, the final thing I would want to say about today is that far more important than whether or not we agree on what I've just presented, which I think you can tell is my own position with regard to war and violence, far more important than whether or not you agree that we all ought to be pacifists, is the fact that on the nuclear question, I think that both traditions lead us to the same conclusion. Both the just war tradition and the nonviolent tradition, I think, lead us to say that Christian people cannot, in the name of Jesus, go on with nuclear weapons and walk further and further down a road that leads to almost certain nuclear war.
Ron, why limit it to nuclear weapons? With the case you presented today, I don't see why nuclear weapons ought to be the exception.
Well, I don't think so either. But if you're in the just war tradition and think that conventional weapons could, under some circumstances, be justified, the use of conventional weapons, you know, I can understand how that case is made. Now, even, I mean, the kind of biological weapons we have today, the kind of weapons that we use to, you know, firebomb cities, you know, even those things, it seems to me, are virtually in the nuclear category. But at least some more modest forms of conventional weapons could be justified, people have thought, on the basis of the just war tradition. So that's why I put it the way I did.
But how are you able to make that kind of a judgment, that one life is less important than a million?
Yeah, well, I think that's a good question. You know, that would be a question that the just war tradition would have to wrestle with. But it does. I mean, the seventh criterion that we talked about yesterday was the question of proportionality.
Oh, also, Bonhoeffer, he seemed to be very, very much opposed to the Nazis and seemed to be able to see that what they were doing was pretty drastic. But as you say, that's not always possible to do, especially with modern propaganda.
Yeah, the number of people, both Catholics and Protestants, who resisted Hitler are just astonishingly small. But move to a different one. I mean, I have just recently been with people from both Argentina and England. And you talk to people in both the societies, and it's clear that the societies, almost all of British society, was solidly in support of England's fighting that war. And virtually everyone in Argentina was in favor of Argentina fighting that war. And the church, in both cases, I think the Archbishop of Canterbury actually made positive statements on the British side. And a very good friend of mine, René Padilla, some of you may know his name, said how just horrified he was to watch how the church in Argentina just sort of wholeheartedly joined in. He was probably one of the handful of exceptions. He, in the course of that time, became a pacifist.
Did the church support Truman when he dropped the bomb during the Second World War? On that decision, on whether that...
The church was certainly not consulted ahead of time, but and after it was over, it didn't make any difference.
There was nothing could have been done about it afterwards, but I meant, was there any planning long enough ahead so that the church could have had anything?
Well, no, in that case, you know, it was top secret.
Was it a decision made by top officials carried out?
Yeah, I mean, the whole... project to develop nuclear weapons was a top secret project, and very few people knew about it until it was actually used.
Ryan?
Yeah.
I think it's important for us to...
Just before you... Well, go ahead.
Oh, was there something
else? No, go ahead. I'll come back to something.
Is that changing the subject?
I was going to say one thing. Oh, let me just say this. It's an interesting story. A few years ago, I met a man out on the West Coast here, who was a chaplain of a Christian college, of a college in the Quaker tradition, which makes it especially ironic. And he was in the army and on one of the three crews that were trained to drop the bomb in Hiroshima. And when they drew straws, he didn't make it. But he still feels a little bad about that. He thinks that was a good thing. The startling thing about that was I was there lecturing about questions of justice and the poor, and he told me, he invited me to his class, and on the last day after he listened to what I said about God's concern for the poor and justice, and he said, I'm a God and country person, I wave the flag, I can hardly believe that my country could do anything wrong, but what Ron has said here has been based in the scriptures, and I've got to rethink something.
It's an example for me, the fact that lots and lots of people in our churches really want to follow Jesus and really want to obey the scriptures, and that we can get through even to people who are some distance from us when we take a biblical approach. Yeah.
Well, you said part of what I wanted to say. I just think it's important for us to realize that our discussion of pacifism is not a concern to go through life trying to avoid breaking some rules, but a real question that we struggle with is how do we most closely follow the Jesus way of life in a nuclear age? And I'm sensitive to the fact that your whole presentation was on Jesus and how quickly we got off of Jesus in our discussions. And I think we have a real tendency to do that.
We came back almost entirely to the question of does it work, didn't we?
Right, and as if Jesus didn't go through some of the same struggles or doesn't have anything to say to us 2,000 years later of that experience. So I was just sensitive that we moved off of the Jesus question so quickly.
I think it's because it really is tough. I mean, it's really tough to genuinely live that way, even in our interpersonal relationships. You know, and to move beyond that societal level is very tough. I think we probably should respect the hour and stop. I'd be glad to talk with any of you who want to carry that conversation on for a bit.
Thank you.